This is Second Look. I'm Bob Levicky, WMRE's news director. I am grateful for your company on this afternoon. A rainy day is a good day to get caught up on the WMRE news of the week, and so we shall in the next half hour. Marguerite Gallerini filed two reports last week, one about the second annual Memories Matter Fair in Charlottesville, an exhibit of some very personal African-American artifacts, family photos, a hair-crimping iron, toys. And Marguerite also explains the findings of a new study co-authored by a UVA ecologist about the effects of all that winter road salt on freshwater life and even on our drinking water. And we'll hear from Jeff Shapiro about the week in Virginia politics. But first, earlier this month, Charlottesville officials met to begin crafting a strategy to fight an affordable housing crisis. On February 16th, the city hosted its first ever housing summit, bringing together dozens of stakeholders for a day-long attempt to find common ground. WMRA's Jordy Yeager has this report.
In Charlottesville, one in five people earn less than $23,000 a year, says Stacy Pathia, the city's housing program coordinator. But the majority of Charlottesville's available housing is only affordable to people earning two to three times that. Speaking at Friday's summit, Pathia said in part that's because over the last two decades, Charlottesville's population has grown rapidly.
And our population is expected to grow by another 7% by 2022. So the housing situation needs to be addressed now so that we don't fall deeper into an affordable housing hole as we move forward.
Pathia organized the conference in hopes that city officials, developers, activists, nonprofit heads, community organizers, and business leaders could better coordinate a response to the growing crisis. Over the last 15 years, as more white middle and upper income people have moved to the city, paying more for housing in the process, it's driven up the market, making fewer options available for low-income residents, many of them African American. Nikaya Walker is the city's first female African-American mayor. She said what's made this housing trend possible is part of a much larger pattern.
We're not in a place where we're just talking about housing. We're talking about undoing a legacy that's been in place for 400 years.
In 2010, the city set a goal to have 15% of its housing be affordable for low-income residents by 2025. But since then, it's stayed at about 10%, as developers have averaged just one affordable unit for every 20 market-rate units that they build. As city officials continue crafting an affordable housing strategy, Walker and others are advocating for the lowest-income earners to be at the center of that conversation. About an hour into Friday's program, City Councilor Kathy Galvin acknowledged that historically, this has not been the case.
I just wanted to say, the city has done a terrible job engaging its community. We are slowly shifting the big ocean liner around.
Claudette Grant said it's not just conversations around housing that low-income residents are left out of. Grant works as a community organizer in Friendship Court, a neighborhood that uses Section 8 funding to subsidize 150 apartments in the heart of Charlottesville's thriving downtown, just two blocks away from the pedestrian mall.
They all said, we don't go downtown. We don't like downtown. We don't like the mall. We don't feel comfortable there.
And that's not exactly a new sentiment. Joy Johnson remembers when the city razed several African-American neighborhoods in the name of economic development in the 1960s. After the bulldozing, more than a dozen black-owned businesses closed their doors, their customer base displaced. It severely hurt the city's black middle class. Johnson mentioned this past summer's white supremacist rally in Charlottesville.
And what happened on August the 11th and August the 12th? Just unveiled the ugliness of what we have been living with.
Part of that reality was a long practice of restricting the sale of homes in certain parts of Charlottesville in favor of white people. These restrictive covenants prevented black people from amassing wealth through home ownership, says Jeff Fogle, a local civil rights attorney and activist. Fogle questioned whether the city's current zoning map was drawn to mirror those covenants.
If that's the case, if in fact our zoning map was drawn on the basis of restrictive covenants, we got to throw out the zoning map, start all over again, and look at our community as it exists today with the moral values that we have today.
These realities are very present as the city attempts to craft a comprehensive plan to govern all future growth. It's conducting a housing study to determine exactly how many additional units are needed and for what income levels. In the meantime, the city's designated nearly $2.5 million this year to support the construction of about 100 new units of affordable housing. That money will also launch a $900,000 rental assistance program and a landlord risk reduction program, among others. Councilor Galvin said all of these steps and more are needed, But as the city's longest-serving councilor, she reminded people that just 20 years ago, the entire city was struggling financially. It was losing money, developers weren't building, and residents were leaving. So the city rezoned to incentivize growth and revenue, with the aim, she said, to use that money to fund social services for the lowest-income earners.
I think it's really important that to keep a thriving city, you got to do the equity thing. And you got to do the viability thing. You got to have that strong economy so that the city can keep funding these things. It can't be a zero-sum game. We can't support you unless we are a strong city financially.
Later this week, the Housing Advisory Committee will meet to discuss the next steps, including whether to delay the city's comprehensive plan until the housing needs assessment is completed. For WMRA News, I'm Jordy Yeager.
Also in Charlottesville, an effort to preserve local African-American history. Monticello and the Jefferson School's African-American Heritage Center and more than a dozen other partners organized the second annual community history fair in Charlottesville called Memories Matter. WMRA's Marguerite Gallerini has the story.
The auditorium of the African-American Heritage Center was full of life, present and past, including an iron toy boat on wheels.
This was a toy that has been handed down from my family. They say that this is well over 100 years old. I can remember having a string there, and it used to scrape up the hardwood floors at the house. So Mom put it away for years, and I finally found it again.
This is Ruby Boston, who's more than happy to talk about her family's history.
This was a crimping iron. You'd get it nice and hot, and it would put waves in your hair. Oh, what a gruesome task it was, because the hair had to be straightened back then. It was not acceptable for us to have our hair as it is now. So on Saturday nights, in the kitchen, traditionally, we would have our hair done. And with hot utensils, we would have burnt ears and neck. Oh, I'm so glad we're here now.
Memories Matter is a local history fair organized by Monticello. Nia Bates, public historian of slavery and African-American life, is the driving force behind this event.
I put together this event in partnership with my colleagues at Monticello in an effort to showcase local African-American history, but also to show the ways that we preserve our own history. But it's important that we come see the community here and that they get to interact with us in a way that isn't all about Monticello giving information. In this instance, it's about how we work with other people in the community to accomplish the same goal.
It is a way of letting people know about current projects at Monticello, but it's also about giving expert advice to the community, says editor Jeff Looney.
We're here representing the Papers of Thomas Jefferson Retirement Series, which is hosted by Monticello. And our job is to produce the definitive edition of Jefferson's letters and papers from his retirement from the presidency in 1809 until his death. We want to be a resource if somebody has a family letter or paper or document, because we know something about transcribing documents and about we can advise them on how to take care of it, but above all, what to do with it, how to transcribe it accurately and that sort of thing.
Memories Matter also featured a set of short films, among them Fifeville by UVA's Kevin Jerome Everson, which documents the Fifeville neighborhood in Charlottesville.
This gray building right here used to be a store. Black on.
Besides Monticello, other booths were sharing pieces of local history. For instance, historian Alice Cannon from the Ivy Creek Foundation talks about how Ivy Creek Park was once a farm, Riverview Farm, owned by a freed slave called Hugh Carr.
And what we're trying to show is that Ivy Creek was not an isolated little farm. Ivy Creek was a farm, one of the most prosperous farms, but within this whole area of African-American land ownership. So it was a community that was connected. Churches in the rural areas had services alternate weeks. So even if you went to this church one Sunday, you went to this church the next Sunday, you would get to know the people in that community. The presence of these strong, interconnected communities is something that lies just beneath the surface.
And here's another piece of local history. One of Hugh Carr's daughters, Mary Carr Greer, became the principal of Albemarle Training School, which was the African-American high school, and Greer Elementary School was named after her in 1979.
I've learned so much today about a school I went to, and I didn't know the history of that.
That's Lily Williams, a member of the local West African dance company, Chihamba.
Even though I'm from this area, some of the things that I learned today, I just did not know. It's just a big history lesson for me. It's so important to keep these memories alive, you know, make people proud of where they come from.
For WMRA News, I'm Marguerite Gallerini.
A recent study focused on a water pollutant that we all know very well, salt. In particular, de-icing salts used during the winter. Over the years, the pH level of many streams across Virginia and the nation have become more and more basic, endangering aquatic life. And Marguerite has the scoop on that story as well.
This is the first study to assess long-term changes in freshwater salinity and pH at the continental scale, and its results show a significant increase in the amount of salt in 232 streams across the country, leading to a basic pH of the water, a phenomenon called alkalinization, which is caused by different factors.
Road salts, agricultural runoff, municipal land use change, and the presence of more and more paved surfaces and things like that that could contribute to runoff. Because instead of the water infiltrating into the soil, it tends to shoot down the concrete and pathways and get into a ditch or a drain and then out into the stream. So it just increases the rate of runoff.
That's Michael Pace, an aquatic ecologist and a professor in the Department of Environmental Sciences at UVA. He is one of the co-authors of this national study, which was published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences.
Freshwater life, the organisms that live in streams and rivers, can't withstand really alkaline conditions. If it's really alkaline, some of the chemicals in the water become toxic, and organisms just can't survive under those conditions.
And what consequences would that have for us?
For human health, there are two issues there. One is that if your fresh water is more salty, it may be problematic for people that have certain dietary restrictions, people that have diseases where they have to regulate their chemistry very carefully. Well, then you don't want to drink water that's really rich in chemical content. And a second context is that if you pull, let's call it salty, alkaline water into your pipes, that can be hard on the plumbing and create a variety of problems, either for the individual homeowner who might have a well or for the water management agency that might be managing a large infrastructure of pipes.
Flint, Michigan is a notorious example of a city changing its water source and then discovering that without treatment, the extra alkalinity degraded the pipes and increased the levels of lead in the water. While this is an extreme case, it shows the kind of cascade of issues water management agencies can face with alkaline water. And not just them. It takes a common effort to address this issue. Here's Will Eisenberg, who works on water quality assessment at the Department of Environmental Quality in Richmond.
We've been trying to engage, you know, a number of different stakeholders that we don't normally work with. We're working with public safety officials. We have the state police involved. We're working with public water supply purveyors, because once this stuff makes it downstream to where they pull water in to then deliver drinking water to the public, they have to deal with the issues that come downstream to them as well. And so we're trying to bring a number of different people to the table, and we're really trying to balance all the competing, yet in many cases, complementary needs of the stakeholders so that we can try and develop the best strategy for Northern Virginia to reduce these salt loads and, you know, of course, maintain public safety.
To this end, some practices have changed already. The Virginia Department of Transportation is constantly trying to improve their de-icing strategies. Staff training, weather monitoring, and now pre-treatment are all part of the equation. They're also testing blue salt, salt dyed in blue, which makes it easier to spot which zones have been treated and to avoid oversalting. Another thing is a liquid form of salt called brining.
Salt only works when it's in basically liquid form. That's when it's most effective. That's why the brining is so effective.
That's Bronco Vlasic, the State Maintenance Division Administrator at VDOT.
Prior to 2008, we didn't do a lot of brining. But after that, we have found that, you know, before every event, and plus brine is only 23% salt. So we really get a big bang for the buck. The other thing that we're doing, and this has been significant too, we're installing speed controls on our spreaders. right now, if you don't have speed controls on your spreaders, it means that you're going to put the same amount of salt on the road, whether you're traveling 5 miles or 50. What this does, it basically, if you're at a stoplight, it stops. The driver doesn't have to do anything. 5 miles an hour puts a little salt. If you're going 50, it's going to put a little more. This makes sure that we're putting the appropriate amount, whether we're traveling 5 miles an hour or 35 miles an hour, so that we're not over-salting.
VDOT is not the only player, though. A lot of de-icing salt runoff comes from big shopping centers and airports, for instance, which are more concerned about liability issues from customers slipping on the ice or other related hazards, and so they will tend to over-apply salt. The main issue remains that of communication and awareness to all parties involved, public and private.
So beyond just identifying what best practices can allow us to more efficiently and effectively apply salts, there's also a huge education and outreach component that we're going to need to consider so that we can get the word out, you know, on better practices for homeowners to use, as well as, you know, acknowledgement of what VDOT recommends and things like that.
For WMRA News, I'm Marguerite Gallerini.
Finally, let's check in again with Jeff Shapiro, political columnist with the Richmond Times-Dispatch, here talking with WCVE's Craig Carper for some analysis of the week in Virginia politics.
Jeff, after hours of debate, both the House and Senate passed dueling versions of a Titanic $114 billion budget. Now they have to iron out the differences between the two.
The big, big difference, of course, between the House and Senate versions of the budget: Medicaid for Obamacare. The House, which for 4 years battled Terry McAuliffe on this and prevailed, suddenly is supporting Medicaid for Obamacare with a catch: a work for benefits requirement. The Senate version of the budget does not include Medicaid expansion. That may strike some people as odd, given that it was within the Senate that there were a few moderate Republican voices who argued for this expansion. Among the reasons the House shifted its position is the arithmetic. By taking all of this federal money, and we're talking billions over years, at least initially, it will free up more than $400 million, money that can go into other goodies that are particularly important to politicians looking to 2019 and an election year. But with that extra $400 million, there's more money for financial aid for college students, more money for pay raises and bonuses for state employees and school teachers and state-financed local workers, such as sheriff's deputies and clerks of courts and treasurers and all of their employees. More money for an emergency fund, and that's been a big deal, particularly with the credit rating agencies. They were very nervous about Virginia balancing its budget with that so-called rainy day fund. Also, a lot of bricks and mortar, but largely paid for with the state's credit card by going into the bond markets. The Senate budget, because it doesn't draw on Medicaid, has had to make a lot of cuts. It's a tighter, more parsimonious budget. And that means that as the House and Senate go into negotiations, the conference committee, it's called, they're going to be pretty far apart. But one particularly interested party in all this will be Governor Northam. The Democrat, of course, favors Medicaid expansion. He is not hostile to the idea of some type of work requirement. Of course, has been adopted most recently in Kentucky. And presumably he will be an active third party in these negotiations.
And Jeff, 20 Republicans made the calculation that it was in their interest to vote for a budget that expanded Medicaid. 31 Republicans did not. What goes into these numbers?
Well, the Republicans in the House and the Senate cast different votes on Medicaid expansion for the same reasons. Remember, the House Republicans had a majority of nearly 2-1 before this election. It's been reduced now to 2 seats. So the Republicans in the House are gambling, particularly with this work for benefits requirement, that they have some cover with the right wing of their party, that this is considered a disciplined approach to this enterprise, but also maybe it will have the added effect of making Republicans look a little less hard-hearted to more moderate swing voters. Remember, there are a couple of Republicans still hanging on in places like outer Northern Virginia, one actually in Fairfax, and there were a couple of Republicans displaced in Virginia Beach, where Republicans can be very strong. Maybe these positions will make it a little easier for Republicans to claw back, not just protect their majority in 2019, if not sooner, but perhaps build it out. On the Senate side, those larger districts that are deemed reflexively Republican, I think the gamble here is that the Republicans need to tamp down threats from the right, diminish the primary threat, and that's why they're taking this position. We'll see. Remember, there were five Senate districts that went for Ralph Northam last year, two in the Richmond area, one held by Glenn Sturdivant, the other by Siobhan Donovan, and there was a sixth district that nearly went for Ralph Northam. And if the polls showed us anything ahead of the election, it was not just distaste for Trump that was driving the anti-Republican vote. It was concern about health care and the perception that Republicans weren't interested in providing it for others, and perhaps were seen as taking it away from those who had it.
And Jeff, now both chambers have passed a major regulation of Dominion Energy, and there was a significant amendment last week on the House side shortly before passage. I believe the Senate is going to agree to that. Are we inching closer to peace in the valley, as they say, at Mr. Jefferson's Capitol?
It would appear that this legislation is a done deal, but not without the utilities, in particular Dominion Energy, and in the western part of the state, Appalachian Power, suffering a huge loss, and that is the elimination of this so-called double dip. Remember, the double dip would have allowed the utilities to keep more than $1 billion in overcharges. Ordinarily, the State Corporation Commission, which regulates the utilities, might order some of that money refunded. That would have been blocked, prevented, impeded. And those dollars instead would have been plowed by the utilities into improvements to their grid. That would include solar and wind. That's that first dip. Then there's the second dip. This is what makes it that double dip. The utilities could then charge their customers for those improvements. That did not go over well with environmental groups. It did not go over well with the big industrial users. It didn't go over well with any of the anti-poverty groups.
Thanks to Jeff Shapiro, political columnist at the Richmond Times-Dispatch. Jeff, we will catch up again next week.
Roger that.
And unfortunately, we're out of time, just as Craig and Jeff were launching into their spiel from the movie Airplane. Roger, huh? What's our vector, Victor? Support for WMRA's News and Information Fund, which makes our award-winning coverage possible, is provided by Bibb and Dolly Frazier, Les and Johnny Grady, Klein May Realty, Eugene Stoltzfus Architects, Joy Loving, Janet Trettner, Nancy Barber, Pam and Jim Huggins, an anonymous donor, and by a grant from a donor-advised fund of the Community Foundation of Harrisonburg and Rockingham County. All of our stories are archived at WMRA.org. If you'd like to support our ability to continue to produce them, go to that website, mouse over news, then click on News and Information Fund. And there's a great way for you to keep up with local and statewide news every weekday with WMRA, including the latest on this year's General Assembly session. Subscribe to our daily news podcast. It's called the WMRA Daily, and get a news update on your smartphone every weekday morning. Find out how at WMRA.org. I'm Bob Levicky, WMRA's news director and morning edition host. I'll talk to you in the morning. Enjoy the rest of your Sunday.